I can have your attention, please. Firstly, it's a pleasure to welcome my colleague, the rabbi of the Unusual North Belmore, Rabbi Dov Schreier, to our congregation this evening, as well as to welcome all of our friends from the Unusual North Belmore for this very special event. As we have been announcing for several weeks at least, we have the pleasure this evening of hearing Divrei Torah from one of the preeminent Talmudic scholars and halachists, certainly in this country and perhaps throughout the world. Rabbi Herschel Schechter has lectured extensively throughout the United States, North America, for almost every and any organization, and has also lectured on many occasions in Eretz Israel, particularly visiting the various yeshivot during the intersession at Yeshiva University to reach out to Talmidim, to students, and to offer them words of Torah. Rabbi Schechter, as I have mentioned, was one of the preeminent Talmidim disciples of the late Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik V'Klaros Livracha, having studied with him for 10 years. He has been giving shiur in the yeshiva program and the rabbinical school, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University, for the past now over 30 years, since the time, as he mentioned to me just before, since the time of the Six-Day War. His official title, he is the Rosh Kollel of the Marcus and Adina Katz Kollel, the Institute for Advanced Research in Rabbinics, as well as holding the Nathan and Vivian Fink Distinguished Professor of Talmud of the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University. Certainly one of the leading Torah scholars of our generation, he is well known for his erudition in Gemara and Halacha. With humility, Rabbi Schechter recently spoke at the Rabbinic Conference of the National Council of Young Israel. And in his topic, which was entitled Kavod HaRabbanus, the honor due to the rabbinate, he spoke about, in passing, that certain rabbis, when they are asked by congregants, where did you receive this particular opinion, the rabbis invariably may say, well, I spoke to a certain scholar or a certain rabbi. I will tell you, and I think Rabbi Schreier will share this with me, that I share many, many questions and issues with this community and beyond with Rabbi Herschel Schechter, and I'm very proud to call him my Rebbe. It is my pleasure to introduce to all of you Rabbi Herschel Schechter.
Thank you very much. We just completed the observance of Pesach, and on all of the Yomim Tovim, when we recite Kiddush and when we recite the Shemoneh Esrei, we start off Atav Achatonu Mikol HaAmim. We praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we thank Him for choosing us as the Yam HaNivchar. We believe that we are the chosen nation. This, of course, posed a great problem for the Jewish people during the Holocaust and afterwards. How can we be considered the chosen nation if we were singled out to suffer more than anybody else? There is one of the many, many, many incidents that was recorded soon after the Holocaust that was published was an incident where one of the Nazis was torturing one of the religious Jews, and he asked the mister, do you still believe, do you still claim that you are the chosen nation, that you are the Am HaNivchar? And he said, absolutely. So he said, but it doesn't make any sense. We're torturing you. How can you say? He said, that's exactly it. I'm not the torturer. I'm the one who's suffering. The one who's the chosen nation would never act like you Nazis. You people are miserable. I'm still a chosen nation. The Talmud relates an incident that occurred at the beginning of the Christian movement, where there was a debate held in pantomime between one of the early Christians. The Talmud refers to the early Christians as Minim, Mem Yud Nun, stands for Mikat Yeshua Natsu, from the followers of Jesus. So the Talmud relates an incident where there was a debate held in pantomime between one of the Christians and one of the rabbis. And very strange, 99% of the story is missing. 99% of all the stories in the Talmud and the Bible are missing. But the part of the story that appears in the Talmud is that this debate was held in the presence of the governor of this region, and the one who was going to lose the debate was going to lose his life. So the debate held in pantomime went as follows. The Christian had the first say. So he looks at the rabbi and he walks away. He goes like this, he walks away. And he said his piece. And then the rabbi turns around to the Christian and he raises his hand like this. So the governor didn't understand, was er gesagt, was jener gesagt? What did the Christian have to say? What did the rabbi respond? So he called the Christian to the side and he asked him, what did you mean by turning your back and walking away? He said that after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews lost their status as being the chosen nation. The temple represents the fact that the Jews are the chosen nation. There were so many miracles that were always present in the temple, but at the time of the destruction of the temple, and the Jews were tortured, and they were sent into exile, so they lost their status. That's, in fact, the Christian position. Till today, that's the position of the Catholic Church. We'll get to that a little later. So he said, that's why I turned my back to the rabbi and I walked away, to show that you lost. God walked away from the Jewish people, and the Jews lost their status as the chosen nation. So then the governor asks the Christian, what did the rabbi respond? He says, I have no idea what the rabbi responded by waving his hand like this. So then the governor calls over the rabbi, and he says, I didn't understand. What was the whole debate? What did he say? What did you say? He says, I understand what he said. He walked away to show that God is walking away from the Jewish people. That's what the Christians claim, that the Jews lost their status as being the chosen nation. And what was your response? He says, no, the Bible says, Od Yod Netuya. If we lost our status as the special nation, so why does God keep on punishing us? So we should be the same as any other nation. The fact that the Jews are still singled out to suffer more punishment than anybody else obviously indicates that we are still the chosen nation. So the Talmud concludes the story. We don't 99% of the story is missing, that the governor decided to put to death the Christian because it was a chutzpah. It was improper on his part to debate and pantomime in the presence of the governor if he didn't understand what the response was. If you're debating in pantomime, so you have to understand what the other party is saying. So if you only know what you're saying, you don't know what he's saying. So that was a chutzpah. So the Talmud says he put to death that particular Christian. It happens that this is the position of the Catholic Church till today. The Catholics claim that the Jews lost their status as a chosen nation because they rejected Jesus. And they say that the land of Israel is the chosen land that's only belonging to the chosen nation. The Eretz HaNivcher is the chosen land, belongs to the Am HaNivcher, the chosen nation. And the Jews don't have a right any longer to have Israel. And this was the official position of the Catholic Church over 100 years ago at the beginning of the Zionist movement. This was their response. It was printed all over the country, all over the world in the different Catholic newspapers. In America it was printed in English, and in France it was printed in French. And in Italy it was printed in Italian, all the different countries, all the different languages. The Catholic Church officially was opposed to the Zionist movement. How can it be? The Jews are not entitled to the land of Israel. They lost their status as the chosen nation when they rejected Jesus as God. And that's why the temple was destroyed. It didn't happen exactly, the dates of the history don't exactly correspond, but this is their claim, that at the time the Jews rejected Jesus, they lost their status as the chosen nation, and that's when they were sent into exile, never to return to the land of Israel until they will accept Jesus as God. So the Jews didn't accept Yoshka yet, so we have no right to return to Israel. So that's why for years the Catholic Church was officially opposed to the Zionist movement. Then when the state was declared, Medina Sisol was established, so the Vatican never recognized it for many, many, many years, until 10 years ago. When was it? Less than 10 years ago. They didn't recognize the Medina, and they were hoping that it was going to go away because it contradicted their whole belief. Like, we have 13 principles of faith. We have the animamas that we believe in, so every religion has their principles, they have their dogmas. So one of the ikori hu'amuna, one of the principles of faith of the Christian, of the Catholic Church is that the Jews lost their status as the chosen nation and they're no longer entitled to the land of Israel because it's the chosen land that belongs to the chosen nation. So how can it be? And they were apart. The Jews can never return to Israel till they'll accept Yoshka as God. So how can it be that they established a state? It didn't make any sense that they were hoping, they didn't want to recognize the state of Israel. They were hoping that it was going to disappear. But it wasn't disappearing. It wasn't disappearing. So they had to figure out some suggestion to defend their position. So they came up with this, published. This is all published, documented. This is not my original idea. So they published that to defend their position. They said The Jews only had the modern part of Israel. They had Tel Aviv, they had all the new settlements in Israel, but they didn't have the old city Jerusalem after 1948. They didn't have the Eir Atika, they didn't have the Temple Mount. They didn't have Hebron, where Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, where our forefathers walked. They didn't have the real Israel. They had the modern Israel. They didn't have Eretz Yisrael. They had modern Israel. They didn't have the real Eretz Yisrael. So after the Six-Day War, when the Jews conquered the Old City and the Jews took over Hebron, they took over everything in Eretz Yisrael. So what was the very next day? What was the response of the Vatican? The Pope said at that time, and till today, the Popes still maintain the same position. The Jews have to internationalize the city of Jerusalem. Why do we have to internationalize the city of Jerusalem? As long as it's under the Arab control, the Pope never insisted you have to internationalize it. And the Arabs never allowed the Jews to pray there by the Kusla Marobi. And now that it's under the Jewish control, they let anybody go. As long as you're not coming with a knife and with a gun to kill somebody, they let anybody come. They allow Christians because this is against their religion. According to their religion, they've been preaching for years and years and years that Israel cannot be given to the Jewish people as long as they don't accept the Yoshke as God. We lost our status as the chosen nation at the time that we rejected Yoshke. So in the beginning, the first couple of years, they said they didn't believe that there was a Medina. It's against everything that they stood for. So in order to defend their position, they said, well, we don't have the real land of Israel. Then when we got the real land of Israel after the Six-Day War, so they said we have to take it away from them because it's against their religion. So you have to take away Jerusalem to internationalize the city in order to defend their religion. And that's why the Pope today, every time the Pope visits Eretz Yisrael, and even when he doesn't visit Eretz Yisrael, every year he makes an announcement. His position is they have to internationalize Jerusalem. You have to understand what it's based on. So this issue of the Jewish people losing their status as the chosen nation, this was raised after the destruction of the first temple. The Jews raised the issue. The Psukim and Navi tell us this. The Talmud has a whole discussion of this in the end of the Tractate Sanhedrin, that the Jewish people raised the possibility. Maybe we lost our status as the chosen nation because the temple is what represents the Bechiras Yisrael, the chosenness of the Jewish people. So God sent his prophets to deliver the message to the Jewish people. No, I haven't divorced you. We're still married. I'm upset. Look, a husband and a wife, sometimes they have an argument. They're not always lovey-dovey. Sometimes they have, but they don't get divorced every time they have an argument. So God sent the prophets to deliver the message to the Jewish people. He's upset, but he didn't divorce them. We still maintain the status as the chosen nation. So the Jews accepted the words of the prophets after the destruction of the second temple. And every time there was another pogrom in Europe, and every time there were the crusades, and every time there was another tzara, and the non-Jews kept on claiming, the Christians and all the other non-Jews kept on claiming, that the Jews lost their status as the chosen nation. And we know that it wasn't so. We were told by the prophets, the fact that God is singling out the Jewish people, he still treats us differently from all the other nations, means that we still retained our status as the Am HaNifra, as the chosen nation. Everybody asks the question, and it's a murderous question to know, where was God? How did God allow all of this to happen during the Holocaust? We believe, we have 13 principles of faith. Rambam lists off what he considers of the 13 principles, Animam is the 13 principles of faith. So we believe that God is aware of what's happening in the world. And we believe that God cares about what's happening in the world. He's a good God. He's a kind God. And we believe that God has the ability to control things in the world. So if God knows what's happening and God cares about it, he's a good God. And he has the ability to intervene and to prevent people from doing wicked. And we believe that God rewards the righteous and he punishes the wicked. So how could he have allowed such a terrible thing to happen? How did God allow all the terrible things to happen during all of the years? The history of the world, we see righteous people suffer and wicked people prosper. So this was a problem that was raised by Moses and the Chumash we have, Moshe Rabbeinu, requests of God, Hodieni noz derachecho, explain to me, how do you run your world? If we believe, if there's more than one God, then there's no problem. If there's more than one God, so one God is running the business, he has one opinion, he runs his part of the world one way, the other God runs his part of the world the other way, so he can have contradictions. But if you believe that there's only one God, and God is aware of everything that's happening, and he does care, and he's a good God, and he has control, so how does he allow all the terrible things to happen? So this is a major problem that bothered all the prophets, that bothered all the philosophers, throughout all the generations. And God says he can't explain to us the answer. The Talmud points out that the verse in the book of Shemos, in the end of Parshas Kisisa, when Moshe Rabbeinu requests of God, when Moses asks God this question, explain to me, how come there's a tzaddik v'ralo, a rosh v'tovlo, how come you have righteous people who suffer and there are wicked people who prosper? So God responds to him. God explains, he doesn't really explain. Gashas answers, v'ra'isa sachorai ufonai la'iro. It's a very obscure answer. It's a very unclear answer. So what does it mean? You will see me from behind, but you can't see me face to face. So the commentaries explain that what it means is, after all of history will be unfolded, after everything will be developed, and you look in hindsight, you look back at the development of all of history, then we will see that it was never the case. There was never really a case of a tzaddik who suffered and of a rasha who prospered. When everything is taken in proper perspective, it comes out that there's no problem of evil. If you look at only one section of this story, of the history of the world, then it looks like it doesn't make sense. Just to give a very elementary example, let's say we all take our children to the doctor to give them injections so they shouldn't get the chicken pox and they shouldn't get all of the different diseases. So the child is screaming bloody murder, why is the doctor pushing this into his arm? Why is he mutilated? The kid wants to run away and have rachmanis, he's crying to his mother. The mother loves the child, the doctor loves the child, the pediatrician loves the child. He's giving the child an injection to prevent him from getting sick later on. So if you would take the whole picture into proper perspective, you can't explain it to the child that there are sicknesses that go around and it's better to have the injection now than to get sick later. And so on and so forth. So all of history is like that. If you take only one part of the picture, so does it make sense? You have a murderous kasha, how come you have the righteous are suffering and the wicked are prospering? But if you look at all of history, after everything will be unfolded, so then God tells us, after everything, in hindsight, we'll be able to understand everything that developed over the years. When we'll put everything in the proper perspective, we'll see that there was no problem. However, but looking in advance, as the history is developing right in front of our eyes, things will not make any sense. And God says he can't explain to us. There's a famous passage in the Talmud where the Talmud comments on the Pasuk, every day of the year in the Holy Temple, sacrifices were offered. According to Tom Shal Shachar, Tom Shal Banabayim, a minimum of two sacrifices were offered every day. And on Shabbos, and on Yontif, and on Chol HaMoed, and on Rosh Chodesh, additional sacrifices were offered. That's what we call the Musafim, the additional sacrifices. So there's a phrase that appears only in connection with the special sacrifice that was brought on Rosh Chodesh once a month. It says we should bring Achatos Lashem. It sounds as if God sinned, and God needs a kapara. God asks us to bring a sacrifice on his behalf. Who is he bringing the sacrifice to? Himself. God is asking of us, we should bring a sacrifice on his behalf. What sin did he do? So the Talmud says, God needs an atonement for the sin that he did. What's on Rosh Chodesh? What happened on the first of the month? Once a month, every month on Rosh Chodesh. Because originally the Pasuk, that sounds humorous, originally the Pasuk in the beginning of Chumash, beginning of Bereshis, describes when God created the sun and the moon, they were both Shnei Hamaoros Hagadolim, two gigantic luminaries. And then all of a sudden the story changes, there's a Mor Hagadol, there's a sun, and then there's a Mor Hakatan, there's a moon. So the rabbis had a tradition, whatever this means, that originally the moon was tremendously big, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, God decided to make the moon smaller. So the moon is complaining, what did I do? I'm a tzaddik v'ra'lo. What did I do? Why did God punish me? What did I do that's wrong? So it's taka bitter rachmanis on the moon. We're all crying and we're all angry at God. Why he was memayit dilavana? And if you'll pay attention in the Sira every month, usually on Motzei Shabbos, after we finish davening, after we finish saying havdol and shul, so you walk outside once a month, so we see the new moon, so we recite a special blessing. It's not a blessing to the moon. We don't bless the moon. We bless God for creating the moon, for creating the sun, the moon, the stars, and for creating the whole wide world, for everything that we have. So we recite a special blessing, and we see the moon being renewed every month. So then, after we recite the special blessing, the bracha, we pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Aisazar Achmanis on the moon, he should make them, Tamale Pegimas Halvana. The Rabbanu Shalom should make the moon big again. From all the tzaras on the whole wide world, there are people dying, and there are people suffering, cancer, and all kinds of sicknesses, and people are out of jobs. So we're worried about the moon. That the moon is crying, what is it all about? That the Pegimas Halvana, who cares about the moon from outer space? So the answer is the Pegimas Halvana, the fact that the moon is small, is a a phrase that represents this concept of Tzadik V'Ra'ala Rosh V'Tovah. It's a phrase that represents the problem of evil in the world. The moon is depicted by the Talmud in this Medrash, in this Agadic passage, as complaining to God, why did you punish me? So God says, Haviva like kapara, once a month, every month, when the moon disappears and then it reappears again. So God says, Chatasi, I can't explain to you now. When all of history will be developed, you'll see, when all of history will be unfolded, you'll see that I didn't do anything wrong. Everything was right. But right now, it looks like God did an avla gedola. So God says, for the meanwhile, bring a korban, Haviva like kapara. Take in your, according to your perception, according to our human perception, right now it looks as if God did many avlas. But we believe that Hatsur Tomim Pa'aloi, whenever any tragedy occurs, we believe that God is kind and God is good, and when taken in proper perspective, everything is good. In fact, this is a famous pasuk in the end of the very beginning of Bereshis, when the creation of the world is described. So it says, on the first day God created this, the second day He created that, and after 6 days of full creation, it says, "Vayara lekim kol asher asam." God saw everything that He had created. V'hinei tov miod. Every day it says, "Vayara lekim kitov." Everything is kitov, kitov. And after everything is finished, "Vayara lekim kol asher asam." You saw everything that He created, and it's tov miod. Wonderful. Every day is tov. It's good. And after everything is all over, it's tov miod. So there's a famous comment that the Medrash has on that pasuk. Not to be understood, the Medrash says, Tov Miyod, Zeh HaMobis. That refers to death. When people die, that's Tov Miyod. What's so Tov Miyod? That's a tragedy. When people die, it's usually a tragedy. What kind of a comment is that? So the commentaries all understand the Medrash as saying the following. It's Vayar Lekimus Kol Asher Asa. If you look at everything that God created, if you have everything in proper perspective, then even death will also be viewed as Tov Miyod. Everything is Tov Miyod. And if you look just at the death of an individual, Nebuch, this fellow died in the accident. His wife had a baby he just killed the other day. This taka tragedy. Every time people die, most of the time, a person lives till 120, fine, and he dies in peace. And so that's not a tragedy. But normally a person dies in Nebuch a tragedy. So if you take it out of context, or you just have a small context, it's taka bitter rachmonis, it's a tragedy. But if you look at everything, Vayaral kemes kol asher asa, if you look at everything from the beginning to the end, so our emunah is that everything is going to be viewed as tov miyod. If we would really have the correct picture, we would see that it's not so terrible. The adrabah, it's wonderful. What the Rabbi Shalom did is a wonderful thing. This problem that bothers us all along, where was God all along? And where was God during the Crusades? And where was God during all of this? This was prophesied by the prophets in advance. Moshe Rabbeinu, before he died, delivered a prophecy to the Jewish people. In the very end of Chumash Devarim, the very end of the whole Chumash, in Shiras Hazinu, in the poem that he recited in Hazinu, so he prophesies in advance that there will be a Holocaust, that it'll be so terrible that the people will say, "Yomar Ei Eloheim Otzur Chasoyabo." Where was God while all of this was happening? And this theme is repeated in Tehillim in several psukim. The way the Jews will ask, where was God? And the nations of the world will ask, where was God? And it says that God is there and He has His reasons why He did this. And He shouldn't ask any kashas. And in fact, if you look in Ha'azinu, it's very fascinating. What is the concluding verse? What is the concluding line in the Shiras Ha'azinu, in this last prophecy that Moshe Rabbeinu gives, when he says a time will come where there will be such a terrible Holocaust, and the people will wonder, where was God? So the concluding line is, after all of this is all over, Acharei kechlos hakol, what's going to happen? V'chiper admoso amo. God will appease His land, and God will appease His nation. So it's assumed, that's the simple translation of the pasuk. Everyone is familiar with the Talmudic additional level of interpretation. You see, there are many verses in the Bible where there's a simple translation. And we believe that the author, God is the author of the Bible, that the author had, in addition to the simple meaning, he had a hidden meaning. There are many poems and there are many books written by non-Jews, written by secular people, where there's an obvious meaning and there are one or two hidden meanings. So we believe that the Bible was authored by God in such a way that Eina Mikri Yotzei Midei Pshuta, the simple meaning is certainly correct, but there are hidden meanings, there are additional levels of meaning. So on this particular verse, V'chiper Admosai Amoi, the Talmud has a famous comment. We know that there's a common practice that when someone dies, so we send the body to be buried in Israel. What kind of story is that? What's the difference whether you bury the person here, you bury the person there? No, that's based on this passage in the Bible that it says the chiper, one acquires kapara, one acquires an atonement for sins that one did. The chiper admosai amoi, the land of Israel accomplishes an atonement for people if they're buried in Israel. That's how the rabbis of the Talmud understood an additional level of interpretation. That's not the simple translation of the words. And then the rabbis say, it's certainly better if you live in Israel. If you live in Israel while you're alive and you function there, that's more of an atonement. That's more of a kapara. But even if a person didn't live in Israel and his body is buried in Israel after he dies, so there's a lower level of atonement. So that's the concept that's contained within this pasuk, v'chiper admos amoy. That's the additional level of interpretation, that the land of Israel will accomplish an atonement for the sins of the Jewish people. But what's the simple translation of the pasuk? What's the simple meaning? So Rashi in his commentary on the Bible writes, v'chiper admos amoy, after this terrible Shoah, after this terrible Holocaust will occur to the Jewish people, and the Jews and the non-Jews will ask, where was God? The Amar Elohim, where was God while all this was happening? So the pasuk concludes, after everything is all over, God will appease his land and God will appease his nation. What happened after the Second World War? The Jews got back Eretz Yisrael after so many years, almost 2,000 years of not having the land of Israel, against the Catholic Church and against all the nations of the world. And then the Jewish people were rebuilt like they never had before. You never had so many people studying in Shivas like you have today. There's more Torah going on now in Israel and America than ever before, even in Europe. Before the war, that they had so many tzaddikim and so many rabbanim, so many people learning in the yeshivas. I remember when we were students in the yeshiva, we had Rabbi Gerelich. You may remember Rabbi Gerelich taught in yeshiva. He told us, you boys have an imagination about the way things were in Europe before the war. You shouldn't be fooled. It wasn't as glorified as you think it was. He says he learned in the Meir Yeshiva in Europe. He said there were 400 students in the Meir Yeshiva in its heyday, from 400 different cities, not 400. He said, now you go to Borough Park, you have a yeshiva on every corner. The 400 people on one block go to yeshiva, the 400 people on the other block go to yeshiva. And you people think they were all tzaddikim. He lived in Lithuania. He says, you think they were all tzaddikim. In Poland, they were Hasidim, they were very righteous. He says, in Lithuania, a lot of them were communists. A lot of them were not so religious. He says, don't, a Holocaust. They killed tzaddikim. They killed many people. But we don't have to imagine that it was greater than it was. It's bad enough the way it was. So the pasuk promises to us, Moshe Rabbeinu promises to us in his prophecy, after this Holocaust will occur, the chiper admosa, God will appease his land by rebuilding Eretz Yisrael, which clearly occurred after this Holocaust. And the Chiparama, God will appease his nation, that things picked up for the Jewish people and much better than it was before the Second World War. Things are improving now. There are terrible things happening now with the Jewish people as well, but it's much better. The situation is much better than it was before the Second World War. What's the story regarding observance of mitzvahs after the Holocaust? What do you mean, what's the story? What's the issue? So there are those who claim to be Orthodox, and they present the following concept. God made a deal with the Jewish people, and he said, you read in the Tochach and the Chumash, that there's an arrangement, there's a contract between the Jewish people and God, that we have to keep his mitzvahs, and God will reward us. And if we violate his mitzvahs, then he's going to punish us. So what happens if God doesn't live up to his half of the deal? So there are those who claim to be Orthodox, and they claim, look, God didn't live up to his half of the deal. He didn't protect the Jews during the Second World War, so we're not obligated to observe our half of the deal. We don't have to keep the mitzvahs either. So the obligation to keep mitzvahs after the Holocaust is no more obligation. It's all voluntary. It's all lifnei Yeshua Sadin. This is ridiculous. This is not only not Orthodox position. This is not any religion. Religion, I assume, any normal religion assumes that God is the one who determines what's right and what's wrong. That we're going to grade God, we're going to give God an F-. We're going to decide. There used to be a fellow, a meshugan in the yeshiva, used to write on all the walls. It was before your time. He used to write on all the walls and all the chairs, F-. He was a meshugan. He said, I'm failing. I'm F, boilam azeh, minus boilam abog. Then I'm a meshugan. So what do you mean over here? We're grading God? We're going to decide that God deserves Rachmon al-Tan? How can you talk like that? We're going to give the Rabbanu Shlomo F- because he didn't stand by the Jewish people. because he didn't live up to his half of the deal, therefore that's why we're not obligated to live up to our half of the deal. Any religion, forget about the Jewish religion, any religion means that you assume that God is the one who decides what's right and what's wrong, and we assume that God always does the right thing. If we're going to decide that we know better than God what's right and what's wrong, so you have people today, they say homosexuality, what's wrong with it? It's lifnei mishuras hadin, it's a mitzvah, it's permissible, it's a mitzvah, times are different. And euthanasia, it's a mitzvah to kill people when they're sick and they're old and they're ailing or whatever, they can't make a living, whatever. You can. That's what led to the whole Holocaust, that the Nazis decided sometimes it's a mitzvah to kill human beings because they thought that they're smarter than God. No? So that's not in any religion. According to any religion, we assume that God is the one who decides what's right and what's wrong. Of course, there's still an obligation to observe the mitzvahs even today. There's no question about that. A question was raised, which is a serious question, after the Holocaust, but this question was raised in earlier generations as well. So many, the overwhelming majority of the rabbis before and during the Second World War recommended to their followers to stay there in Europe. They shouldn't run away to Israel. They shouldn't leave. Everyone should stay behind. In fact, it's famous. It's famous. The Rosh Yeshiva of the Miri Yeshiva had a lot of money. And the Talmidim were afraid in the middle of the war. They said, we have to run away to America. He said, no, we're going to stay here till the war is over. So one of the... There was a famous student of the Miri Yeshiva, Ablev Malin, who was single at that time. He took a knife and he said, I'll kill you! Give us the money! He threatened to murder the Rosh Yeshiva. Ablev Yudel Finkel. He said, he's going to kill him if he doesn't give him the money. So he gave him the money. He had to give him... And that's how they were all saved. He would have been killed also. Ablev Yudel would have been killed also. Later on, he was saved. He went to Israel. They all went to America. He went to Israel. He went to Mozambique. One of the rabbis from the yeshiva told us, Mozambique is a country in northern Africa. He thinks that Mozambique was only recognized as a country. Whatever happens in Mozambique, he said it was only recognized as a country in order to save the Jews after the Second World War. He doesn't know of anything else that happened in Mozambique. He was in Mozambique. They got passports to go to wherever. So the rabbis made such a mistake. Almost all the rabbis made this mistake. They told the Balabatim and they told all of their followers, no one should leave, everyone should stay behind. So how can you rely on the rabbi when they give you any psak on any shaila? How can you have any amunas chachamim? If the rabbis didn't have the common sense to see what was happening under their noses, so how can you rely on them on any psak halacha? So it's interesting, the Talmud tells us such a story occurred at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. At that time, the rabbis used to make all the political decisions for the Jewish people. After the Haskalah movement in the 1700s, so the Maskilim took over the leadership of the Jewish people and they pushed the rabbis in the corner, and the rabbis only make decisions on religious issues and the politics of the Jewish people is decided by laymen. But years ago, until the Haskalah movement, all the political issues were decided by the rabbis. The rabbis were the leaders of the Jewish people. So the one who was making all the decisions in the middle of the destruction of the Second Temple was the chief rabbi, whose name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So the Talmud says that he snuck out of the city Jerusalem. His nephew was the head of the gangsters, the Bir Yonim, and they said they'd rather have every person die than surrender to the enemy. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, representing all the rabbis, said, that's ridiculous. You don't surrender to the enemy, but we lost the war already. Well, there's no mitzvah to wait till everybody gets killed. That's ridiculous. We're going to surrender at least to save a few lives of people. So you had to sneak out of Jerusalem. The Talmud tells the whole famous story. How were they going to let him? They wouldn't let him sneak out. So he made up, he's going to make believe that he's dead. And they're carrying his coffin in order to bury him in the cemetery outside of Jerusalem. The truth of the matter, he was not dead. So after they took him through, they were going to stab his body. The Talmud tells they didn't believe that he was dead, which he wasn't. They thought he was alive and it was a fake. So they were going to put a sword through his body to make sure that he was dead. So they said, chief rabbi, how can you stab the chief rabbi even if he's dead? So they pulled off the shtick and they got out of the city and he was still alive. So he went to visit Vespasian, who was then he was the general of the Roman army in charge of destroying Jerusalem. So he came and he said, he represents the whole Jewish people, he's the chief rabbi, he's basically the president of the Jewish people, they're surrendering. and they want to make peace with them. And the few people who are giving them a hard time in Jerusalem, they don't represent the Jewish people. That's a minority. It's a small minority. I represent the majority of the Jewish people. We're surrendering. So then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told this fellow Vespasian the good news that I realized that you were just appointed emperor, and he didn't hear. Vespasian hadn't heard about it yet, and he told him how he figured it out. And then he was so taken, the general, the Roman general was so taken by the chokhmah of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, so he said, okay, he's fine. You surrender, I accept your surrendering. You can make three requests, and I'll honor all the three requests. Instead of requesting that they should leave the Holy Temple, they shouldn't destroy it. So he said, let me have the city Yavne. Ten li Yavne v'chachamel. Allow me to have a yeshiva in Yavne where the rabbis will study, and another two insignificant things. He asked for the medication for one of the rabbis who was dying. Medication for one of the rabbis. I should have asked, leave the Holy Temple. So that was his request. So they destroyed the Holy Temple, and they gave him Yavne, and they continued having the rabbis meet in the city Yavne. So the rabbis in the later generations condemned Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, because in hindsight, everybody has 20/20 vision. So they said, what an idiot. Why didn't he say, if he's giving him three requests, make one request. Don't destroy the temple. We'll give you all the money. We'll give you whatever you want, but don't destroy the temple. So the rabbis explained, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a stupid mistake. If the chief general, who was so taken by him, who was just appointed emperor, and he knew before the emperor that he was appointed emperor, the message hadn't yet come from Rome, so why didn't he request they shouldn't destroy the temple? So the rabbis quote a verse from the book of Isaiah, where the expression appears, Meshiv chachami mochar v'daitam yisakel, that God suspended his common sense. God suspended the seichel of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. God wanted to destroy the temple for some reason or another. So that's why he made Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai make such a stupid mistake. So that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to say with respect to this fact. How come all the rabbis in the middle of the Second World War made such a stupid mistake? He used to say, yeah, in hindsight, the vision is always 20/20. We see now, looking back in advance, looking back in retrospect, we see that it was a terrible mistake. And at that time, how come almost everybody made the mistake? So he said, the Ribbono Shel Olam suspended their chokhmah, and he made them make such a stupid mistake. But it doesn't mean that we should no longer listen to what the rabbis have to say. We're supposed to listen to the rabbis' suggestions in political issues, and certainly to listen to the rabbis' suggestions in halacha, as far as psak halacha is concerned. There are many who look at the Holocaust and claim that it was not a religious issue at all, because the Nazis were killing Jews who had already converted to Christianity. They were killing people who, according to our religion, were not Jewish at all. They were one-quarter Jewish or one-eighth Jewish, whatever it was. These people, their mothers were non-Jews. So the people who were killed by the Nazis, and the Nazis were killing all the minorities. I remember once, many years ago, I was in the barbershop in Washington Heights, and I had my little son at that time, so I don't know why. At that time, I didn't have a beard. So there was a non-Jew in the barbershop. He says, oh, that's your grandson? I said, no, that's my son. What do you mean, my grandson? I'm not that old. I don't have any grandchildren. So he strikes up a whole conversation with me, this non-Jewish customer there. So we're both waiting for our turn to get a haircut. So he says, we have a lot in common. He's from Albania. And Hitler killed out all the Albanians and wanted to kill all the Jews. We have a lot in common. Yeah. So there are those who claim that the Holocaust had nothing to do with the Jewish people. He was killing all the minorities. And he was killing people who were not even Jewish. He was killing people who had converted to Christianity. It was just a mishigas. It was a craziness that he was killing minorities. It had nothing to do with the fact that the Jewish people were religious. This is not true. We have the records, like we have congressional records, what's discussed in the Congress, so they have the records, they're printed in books. They have the records of the discussions that went on in the German parliament when Hitler and other representatives of Hitler's government were explaining that the Jewish people represent a different hashkafa, a different outlook on life, and a different musr, a different style of morality, which the Germans felt was contradictory to them. And they viewed it as if the entire... They weren't just killing minorities. That was one mishigas that had to kill minorities, but they were specifically killing the Jews, because the Jewish people, they felt, represent a certain style of morality which their country is not prepared to accept. They said so explicitly. That's why they want to kill the Jews. And that is true. The Jewish people do represent God in this world. We are called Am Hashem. We are called, we say in the davening, when we say the davening on Yamim Tovim, we say, Shimcha HaGodol V'HaKodesh Aleinu Karasa, that God has given us a schiyah, He gave us a wonderful gift, that He has incorporated His name into our name, like when a couple gets married. So my wife gets married, so she's called Mrs. Schechter. In other countries, the husband, my wife's maiden name was Shapiro. In other countries, I would be called Mr. Shapiro. Either the husband, normal. Now we live in a funny world. But a normal world, either the husband takes on the wife's family name or the wife takes on the husband's family name to show that they're married, that they plan to be married forever and ever. V'rasta chaliyolam. They plan to be living together for a long time. So when the Jewish people hooked up with God and we were married with God, that's how it's described in the Bible. So the Rebbeinu Shlom did both for us. He took on our name. He is called Elokei Yisrael, the God of the Jewish people. And we are called Am Hashem, God's nation. It's like I would take on my wife's family name, my wife would take on my family name to show that we're geknipten gebunden, that we're married to each other. We both took on each other's family name. So we call ourselves Am Hashem. That's what we refer to in the davening. Shimcha HaGodol HaKadosh. Aleinu Karasa, that God has given us the opportunity to incorporate His name into our name. We are called God's nation. And Shmeinu Karasa Bishmecho, He has taken our name and incorporated it into His name. He is called Elokei Yisrael. So what the Nazis said was correct. What Hitler said in the parliament was correct. The Jewish people represent the Jewish God and they represent a different style of morality. And that's what he was opposed to. That's what the main thrust of the war was all about. A less significant part of the war was that he wanted to wipe out all the minorities, but that wasn't the main purpose. The main purpose was that the Jews represented a special style of morality. Many have pointed out, Lucy Dewitowitz has this in her books and others point out, that more important than asking the question, where was God during the Holocaust, is to ask, where was man? Kasha on God is a kasha on Alta Kasha from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. How come you have Tzadik V'Ra'al and Rasha V'Tov? The problem of evil. So that's a big problem that all the philosophers have been working on. But where was man? The German nation was the most advanced nation. They had the big scientists and all the mathematicians and all the philosophers and everything. And they were the ones that perpetrated this. Where was the German nation? Where were the Jewish nation? Why didn't they run away? What was going on? The Jews just went there. They allowed themselves to be killed. How can it be? And where were all the nations of the world? Everybody just stood by and allowed all of this to happen. That's a bigger question. Not forget about where was God, where was man? There was a major change going on in the world in the century before the Second World War. And that's why all of the theologians today, Rabbi Soloveitchik has a book about this, but other non-Jewish theologians have, they all use the same title, The Lonely Man of Faith. A person has a munna today, feels very lonely. We live in such a different kind of a world where people who believe in God and people who believe that God knows what's happening and God controls the world, they look at us like mishugoyim. It's out of style these days. Nobody believes in this. That's a question. What happened to all of morality of mankind? That mankind it's a different world we live in. People are different from the way they used to be. And this poses a major problem. But just to conclude, I'd like to mention another unrelated issue. These are all issues that we have to take to heart. Rabbi Soloveitchik was very concerned about observing Holocaust Day. What are we going to say about the Holocaust? We don't have the answers to any of the questions. All the questions are very difficult. So when he was once asked what should be emphasized, he said one of the things that he suggested, several things should be emphasized, that the Jews did not allow themselves to be killed just like this, that there was a lot of resistance all over whenever possible. The Jews did resist and they put up a fight. But one of the main things that he said should be emphasized is that whenever there are Jews anywhere in the world whose lives are in danger, it's a sakana for all the Jews all over the world and everybody has to get involved. And we shouldn't think that's their problem, that's not my problem. That's not the case. Whenever Jews anywhere are in danger, we all have to get involved. And I'll just close with this fascinating story. There was a time during the middle of the Second World War when the reports were coming to America that the Nazis were taking over Italy and they were going to kill many thousands of Jews, 80,000 Jews or something. I forgot all the figures. This is written up in the books. So Rav Baron Kotler lived in America at that time, and he was going wild. We have to save the Jews in Italy. How can we possibly do that? So they told him, it's a humorous story, it's what to laugh and what to cry. They told him the only one who can do the job is the mafia. He said, okay, they should take him to meet the man from the mafia. The man didn't speak English. Rav Baron Kotler didn't speak English. So he met with the man from the mafia. I forgot, this is all documented, they have the names. And he said, you have to explain to him in Yiddish, and someone explained in English, was that Yizok, you have to save the Jews. So he said, okay, Rabbi. Maskim shook hands. But he says, you know, it's going to cost you, Rabbi. So he says, whatever it's going to cost, we're going to pay. So he said, no, Rabbi, I don't need your money. I got more money than you can ever raise. You're going to have to pay me, give me a blessing. Rabbi, I want your blessing. You're a holy man. So Baron Kotler had to figure out what kind of a blessing to give the head of the mafia in America. So he said, he thought for a half a minute. He said, God should bless you. It's a true story. You should die a peaceful death on your bed. Because he had a lot of enemies. Everybody was going to... You should die a peaceful death on your bed. Yishalom. You shouldn't be assassinated. The kachave, the man lived to a ripe old age, and he died in his bed. So a few days after he passed away, a big limousine drove up, it's a true story, drove up to Lakewood Yeshiva, and a young guy gets out, the son, and he says he's looking for Rabbi Aaron Kotler. So Rabbi Kotler died years ago. What kind of Rabbi Kotler? He said, is his son alive? So he said, yeah, his son was alive at that time, Rabbi Shneur Kotler. So he said, he has to speak to the son. So he told me, he's not in the yeshiva, he lives over there. So he went to his home, knocked on the door, and he went in with his friends. He went in with his bodyguards, and he says, your daddy gave my daddy a blessing that he should die a natural death on his bed. Your daddy's blessing was fulfilled. My daddy just died last week. Now, Rabbi, you're a holy man. I want you to give me the same blessing. Humorous story, but it's an emes ha'maaseh. Baron Kotler needed help that he should save the Jews in Italy, and he saved up this 90% of the Jews, 80-90% of the Jews whose lives were in danger, and that was what he paid him off with the blessing. So this fellow, so it still remains to be seen whether the blessing of the fellow is still alive. He wasn't assassinated yet. Rabbi Kotler gave him a blessing, he should die a natural death, like my father gave your father a blessing, you should die a natural death on your bed. But just all joking aside, this is one of the most important lessons that's relevant to us today. That if the Jews are in danger in Eretz Yisrael or anywhere in the world, it's our responsibility, it's the responsibility of all of the Jews who live all over the world to protect and defend. And if it's going to cost money, it's going to cost money. If it's going to cost blessings, it's going to cost blessings. Whatever it costs, we have to pay to save the lives of all of the Jews. Thank you very much.